Hello, this is Debbie again on Wednesday, August 17th, 2016, with the e edition of the Herald and Review for Decatur. Starting as usual with the death notices. Groves, Doris Marie, Decatur. Doris Marie Groves, 90, of Decatur, went home to be joined with the Lord and the love of her life on Tuesday, August 16th, at Eastview Terrace in Sullivan, with her family by her side. Funeral services to celebrate the life of Doris Groves will be 12 noon Friday, August 19th, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 11 to noon Friday before the service at the funeral home. Burial will be in Graceland Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis. Decatur, Mays, Donna D. Donna D. Mays, 58, of Decatur, passed away on Saturday, August 13, 2016, in St. Mary's Hospital. Funeral services to celebrate Donna's life will be at 2 p.m. Saturday, August 20th, in Moran and Goebel Funeral Home. Visitation will be 1 to 2 Saturday in the funeral home. Burial will be in Litchfield at a later date. Decatur, Kroll, Craig S. Craig S. Kroll, 56, of Decatur, passed away Monday, August 15, 2016. Graveside services will be held 1 p.m. Friday, August 19th, in Graceland Cemetery. There will be no visitation. Decatur, Powell, Billy K. Billy K. Powell, 85, Decatur, died Wednesday, August 10th. Graveside services, 10 a.m. Thursday, Graceland Cemetery. Arrangements by Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Memorials, Grace United Church. Decatur, Simone, Rose Jeanette. Rose Carmen Jeanette Simone passed away on August 13, 2016, at the age of 82. Visitation will be at 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday in Pittman Funeral Home, Wentzville, Missouri, private burial. Decatur, Swertfeger, Amanda Marie. Amanda Marie Mills Swertfeger, 32, of Fairfax, Iowa, passed away August 13, 2016. Services will be at 6 o'clock Thursday, August 18th at Westdale Community Church, Cedar Rapids, conducted by Reverend Jeff Ball. Visitation 4 to 6 Thursday at a private family burial will be held at a later date. Arrangements by Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Services, Cedar Rapids. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family to be used for Amanda's children. Oh. Sullivan, Horseman, Ivan. Ivan Horseman. Graveside services with military rites will be at 4 o'clock Friday in the Green Hill Cemetery, Sullivan. Visitation will be from 2 to 4 Friday in the Reed Funeral Home, Sullivan. Memorials are suggested to the Sullivan FFA or to the donor's choice. And that ends the local obituaries. Then on that page, TV commentator John McLaughlin dies. McLaughlin died at 89. This is AP out of New York. John McLaughlin, the conservative political commentator and host of the namesake long-running television show that pioneered Hollering Heads discussions of Washington politics, has died. He was 89. McLaughlin died Tuesday morning, according to an announcement on the Facebook page of the McLaughlin Group series. No cause of death was mentioned, but an ailing McLaughlin had missed the taping for his past weekend show, his first absence in the series, 34 years. Since its debut in April 1982, the McLaughlin Group upended the soft-spoken and non-confrontational style of shows such as Washington Weekend Review and Agronsky and Company, with a raucous format that largely dispensed with politicians. Instead featured journalists quizzing, talking over, and sometimes insulting each other. John McLaughlin was a TV institution for generations of Americans, tweeted House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. We will miss his contagious spirit and tireless dedication. In an interview with the Associated Press in 1986, McLaughlin said he felt talk shows hadn't kept pace with changes in television. "I began the group as a talk show of the 90s," he said, adding that he thought informing an audience should be entertaining. The acquisition of knowledge need not be like listening to the Gregorian chant. Critics said the show was more about show business and entertainment than journalism and politics. They said it celebrated nasty posturing, abhorred complexity, featured a group of mostly aging conservative white men spouting off on topics they knew little about. But the format was hugely successful. As McLaughlin himself might have said, on a probability score from 0 to 10, 0 meaning zero probability, 10 meaning metaphysical certitude, in the show's heyday, the chances that a Washington establishment were faithfully turning in each week was definitely a 10. The show began with McLaughlin declaring issue 1 and often featured the journalist pontificating on 4 or 5 issues. It would end with the journalist forecasting the future, usually with a high degree of certainty, if not accuracy, and McLaughlin declaring, bye-bye. End of that. In news from another state, Milwaukee's latest city to use curfew to tamp down unrest. This is from Milwaukee, AP. The neighborhood rocked by violent protests after a black officer fatally shot a black man was calmer after police pledged to strictly enforce a curfew for teenagers in Milwaukee, the latest place where authorities have invoked decades-old, often little-enforced laws to try to tamp down unrest. But the measures are controversial, with some people saying curfews violate civil liberties. Researchers also argue there's little to no evidence that the laws work, particularly when it comes to curbing juvenile crime, and in some cases, the laws only make problems worse in the long term. The most useful aspect of a curfew is it gives the public an impression that the police are doing something, said Kenneth Adams, a criminal justice professor at the University of Central Florida who has studied the laws. It's sending the message that, quote, we the police are serious about restoring order and we're going to take steps, unquote. Authorities in Ferguson, Missouri issued curfews for all residents in 2014 in response to violence that erupted after a white officer shot and killed a black 18-year-old, a move that angered many in the community who saw it as further mistreatment of blacks. After a man died in police custody in Baltimore 2015, the city mayor imposed a week-long curfew, saying she did not want to see the city destroyed by thugs. Milwaukee's enforcement was aimed at teens and followed riots that started after the Saturday shooting of Seville Smith. Police said the 23-year-old was fleeing a traffic stop and had a gun in his hand when he turned toward the officer who opened fire. The state is investigating. Peaceful protests turned violent that night and continued on Sunday evening. Some businesses were set on fire, one person was shot, and multiple officers were injured. Milwaukee's had a curfew law in its books since 1943. It prohibits people under age 17 from loitering in public places between 11 p.m. and 5 a.m. during the summer months and from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. Sunday through Thursday during the school year. The proclamation Mayor Tom Barrett issued Monday expanded the curfew to apply to anyone under 18. It also took effect an hour earlier at 10 p.m. Your teenager better be home or in a place where they're off the streets, he said at a news conference Monday. This is not the place where you go to gawk. This is not the place where you go to take pictures. This is not the place where you go to drive your car around. Police said Monday night was markedly more peaceful, with what the police chief called some heated confrontations and 6 arrests, but no destruction of property. Last night was a much better night, said Milwaukee Common Council President Ashanti Hamilton. I'm hoping we continue down that path. Between Saturday night and Monday morning, police reported 31 people were arrested, including 3 juveniles. After Barrett announced the curfew Monday, 10 people were arrested. One was a juvenile. Experts caution that while the youth curfew may have had an impact temporarily, they are not generally an effective crime-fighting tool. Little juvenile crime occurs overnight, said Adams, adding that you get a bigger bang for your buck in most communities if the curfew were imposed from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. When kids are out of school, parents are less likely to be around, and young people are more likely to cause trouble. Enforcing curfews also requires significant resources that could be better put toward other efforts, researchers have found. There are concerns that they are not uniformly or fairly enforced, with minorities and people in low-income neighborhoods tending to be disproportionately targeted. Enforcement also tends to ebb and flow. After a notable crime or spike in criminal activity, authorities or elected officials will make the often politically popular step of beefing up enforcement. But officers quickly grow tired of it or priorities shift. In Milwaukee, for example, the number of charges filed against minors and their parents has dropped significantly in the past few years. In 2001, 539 minors and 23 parents were charged with violating the curfew law. Last year, charges were filed against 148 minors and 8 parents. The numbers are on a pace to be even lower this year. Mike Mayall, senior researcher at the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, said there's another problem. Curfews don't target the people who are committing crimes. In Ferguson and Baltimore, said authorities blame teenagers for much of the unrest, but arrest logs showed few people taken into custody were teens. Most were considerably older. Targeting that younger population, he adds, serves only to antagonize them. It also allows public officials to avoid addressing larger problems such as longstanding racial disparities and poverty. It's an easy population to blame, Mayes said. It is males. It's an easy population to blame, Mayes said. He's the senior researcher at the Center for Juvenile and Criminal Justice. End of that article. Headlines on page one of the sports page are Biles gets her fourth gold medal, Cub pitchers dominant, and then this article, excitement building for Illinois opener, Champaign. With the season opener just 7 days away, Lovie Smith admits he's getting excited. When the students get into town this week, that adds even more excitement, the Illini head football coach said Tuesday after practice. Team-wise, yes, it's getting close, and the guys can't wait. Illinois takes on Murray State at 2:30 p.m. on Saturday, September 3rd in Memorial Stadium, and circumstances have taken the Illini off their grass practice fields onto the artificial turf for each of their three practices. The team worked out there Saturday night by design, trying to get a feel for playing under the lights, since the second game of the season will kick off at 6:30 p.m. against North Carolina. Then Illinois practiced on the turf Monday, the indoor facility, and Tuesday Memorial Stadium, because rain made the grassy fields soggy. That's the beauty of having training camp here, said Smith, who made the decision to remain on campus rather than take the team to Rantoul, where past Illini teams have trained. When you have a wet field, you move right onto the turf and you don't miss a beat. After practice ended Tuesday, Smith made his most positive statement to date on the state of his first Illini team. "We're getting better, a lot better," he said. "That should be the case in this late in training camp. I just feel like we're going to be a pretty good ball team. We feel like we're going to have everybody in the right spot. We have a good idea what they can do and what their role will be on the team this year." Smith said that while position battles are still being waged, his depth chart is falling into place, and he's used the wide receiver position as an example. "The guys we thought would move into these roles are doing that," he said. Justin Hardy had an excellent camp coming off an injury, broken foot last year. Malik Turner is also kind of leading the charge. Sam Mays is rounding out the form pretty good. "And we're taking a look at some of our younger players, too. The receiving group added a new player when Trenor Davis, a true freshman from Boynton Beach, Florida, shifted to offense after opening camp at defense back. Near the end of practice Tuesday, he made two nice catches and got Smith's attention. We have young skill guys, and we don't know for sure where they're going to end up, and you want to give them an opportunity. He came to me and he played a little wide receiver in high school and he wanted a shot over there. When you get a shot, you need to make a few plays, and he did." Defensive coordinator Hardy Nickerson said he can feel the approach of the season opener. "For a long time, it just seemed so far away, but now it's just a couple weeks away, and you can almost taste that game," Nickerson said. "The atmosphere on campus will change when the students get back. It's coming up on go time." Smith said he expects to return to the grass practice fields today. Practice is open to the public as long as the team doesn't move into the indoor facility. Practice is scheduled from 2:30 to 4:30. End of the football thing. Change is coming. Fall semester classes begin on Monday with students arriving on campus later this week. The annual freshman convocation will be held Saturday, inside Memorial Stadium. That's the final practice of training camp that will be open to the public and media. The arrival of classes means schedule changes and a new layer of responsibility for players. It will add more stimulus, said Andrew Hayes-Stoker, the wide receivers coach. Right now, they're locked in and focused on football. There'll be girls on campus walking around to get their attention. Volleyball number 14. Illinois is ranked number 14 in the American Volleyball Coaches Association preseason poll. But four Big Ten conference schools are ranked ahead of the Illini. Nebraska is the preseason number one ranked team in the country. Minnesota ranked number three, Wisconsin number four, and Penn State number nine. Illinois returns to 10 letter winners and most of its starters from its NCAA Sweet 16 team of a year ago. Illinois has its orange and blue scrimmage at 7 p.m. Saturday at Huff Hall and opens its season on Friday, August 26th at home against Arkansas. On to the money section. Two bushels of corn for each person, maybe. This is the Stu Ellis column. Any way you look at it, $15,153,472,000 bushels is a lot of corn. In fact, it would be two bushels of corn for each of the world's 7,443,735,685 people. At least that was the estimated global census number early Tuesday morning. But it was climbing at such a dizzying rate, it's hard to capture such a slice of data. While the global population may be climbing rapidly, the corn number may not be increasing at a similar rate and may actually be declining. The world's census takers and sociologists can be responsible for determining the global population. But the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Services, NASS, is responsible for counting the bushels of corn that the U.S. farmers are producing this year. And just like the census enumerators visiting a sample number of homes, the agency's enumerators visited a sample number of cornfields to extrapolate an estimate for 2016 corn production. How accurate are those numbers? There may be more confidence in the global population number as it climbs. Oops, now up to 7,443,737,937 than the level of farmer confidence in the USDA's estimate of bushels of corn. In defense of the National Agricultural Statistics Service, it's developed very scientific methods of estimating corn crop size with increasing rates of accuracy with a combination of staff visits to cornfield and interviews with over 22,000 farmers about their crop. The agency is the best in the world at what it does, bar none. However, just like the population digits that fly by, and he gives the next high number, the corn crop is likely not growing as fast, and the number of bushels as of August 1st may actually decline to under 15 billion by the time NASS issues its final report on crop sizes in January. When yield reports come from the field, NASS will adjust its estimate. It seems like every year is tough to rationalize what NASS says the crop size is, since every field is different. Every state has a different average yield, and every part of the nation has sustained weather that impacted the crop in a different way. This year, the eastern Corn Belt was unusually dry, and Ohio and eastern Indiana have a crop that is not up to par with prior years. Monday's crop progress report from NASS indicated that 56% of Ohio corn crop was in fair to poor categories, and only 44% was good to excellent. That compares to 74% of the entire U.S. corn crop being good to excellent and only 26% fair to poor. The statisticians are good at reconciling such difference. But in central Illinois and several other pockets in Iowa, cornfields are exhibiting a phenomenon called tipback, in which the top third of the ear does not produce any grain. Although respected researchers advise farmers not to worry about the issue and discount the good kernels to calculate their yield estimates, other farmers have ears of corn that are fully filled out and may have 800 instead of the 550 or 600 found on an ear with tipback. Fewer kernels will mean fewer bushels in the bin this fall, and even if the 15 billion, 153,472,000 bushels of corn on August 1st declines to less than 15 billion when all is said and done. The United States still will have 2 billion bushels left over at the end of the marketing year a year from now, and no one will go hungry as a result. There hopefully still will be 2 bushels of corn for everyone on the planet, since the population counter is now up to, and he's got it even higher, back or not. Tip back or not. What will you do with your 2 bushels? End of the article. U.S. stocks slip from records. New York AP. U.S. stocks slid Tuesday as investors continued to sell phone company and utility shares. Energy companies rose with the price of oil, but stocks had been locked in an up-and-down pattern for more than a week. As the dollar weakened, the price of oil rose for the fourth day in a row to sustain a recent recovery, and metals price also rose. The Labor Department said inflation remains low as prices paid by consumers were unchanged in July. Most stocks were down, but for the second day in a row, the biggest losses went to traditionally safe investments like telecom and utility companies. Bond prices also inched lower. The dollar has been very strong over the past few years compared to other currencies. Early this year, it looked like the dollar would stay at those elevated levels because the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates while other global central banks were cutting them to stimulate their economies. John Cannelly, chief economic strategist for LPL Financial, said the Fed has changed course. By leaving interest rates where they are, it's allowed the currency to weaken a bit, aiding U.S. manufacturing and energy companies and other exporters. The Fed is using the dollar as sort of a tool of monetary policy, he said. The Fed wants to give China and emerging markets time to heal and get their houses in order. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 84.03 points, or half of a percent, to 18,552.02. The Standard & Poor's 500 Index slid 12 points, or half percent, to 2,178.15. The NASDAQ composite fell 34.9 points, or 0.7%, to 52,27.11. Stocks have been setting records recently, but it's been more than a week since they rose for 2 days in a row. The market hasn't made many big moves over the last month. The Labor Department said prices paid by consumers were unchanged in July, as gas and other energy prices kept inflation down. Core inflation, which leaves out food and fuel prices, inched up just 0.1% for the month. Overall, inflation's just up 0.8% over the last year. That's far below the 2% target set by Federal Reserve, and investors concluded that means the Fed is less likely to raise interest rates soon. The dollar fell to 100.25 yen from 105.25 yen. The euro rose 1.12 from 111. The weakening dollar boosted energy and metal prices Tuesday. Benchmark U.S. crude added 84 cents, or 1.8%, to $46.58 per barrel in New York. Brent crude, a benchmark used to price international oils, rose 88 cents, or 1.8%, to $49.23 in London. Oil prices climbed last week after steep losses in June and July. Metal prices also rose. Gold gained $9.40 to $9.40 to $1,456.90 an ounce. Silver added 3 cents to $19.87 an ounce. Copper edged up 2 cents to $2.17 a pound. Bond prices dipped, and the yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.58% from 1.56%. Stocks have wavered lately as investors review mixed reports about the U.S. economy as they try to get a sense of its health. On Tuesday, the Federal Reserve said U.S. factories cranked out more autos, machinery, and chemicals in July, which suggests manufacturers might be recovering, though growth remains little changed from a year ago, and manufacturers aren't adding more jobs. Meanwhile, the Commerce Department said the pace of home construction grew by the most since February. End of that article. Next, out of Omaha, Nebraska. Omaha's answer to pothole complaints, a new dirt road. Omaha, Nebraska, AP. For miles and miles, Omaha stretches on, one tidy suburban-style neighborhood after another, filled with modern, low-slung houses set on spacious lawns with towering oaks and elms. It's a model of comfortable mid-American living with one unusual exception, thanks to a quirk in how Obama developed. About 300 miles of streets in those neighborhoods are pitted with potholes almost big enough to swallow a SUV. The bad roads have been both an anomaly and a source of complaints for years, but recently they've become the center of a mini-crisis after local officials began dispatching crews to tear up the asphalt in the neighborhoods and turn the streets back into dirt roads, much like what existed in the city's frontier days. The sudden appearance of miles of dirt road in the midst of urban Omaha has prompted angry protests by residents and showcased a conflict over public service homeowners over the public service homeowners should expect when a modern city outgrows some of its old real estate agreements. No letter, no notice. We just come home on Tuesday and our street was ground up, said Joe Skransky, a dentist who lives on 113th Street. 13th Street, where a dozen $400,000 and up houses now line a dirt path. Since then, it's been nothing short of a nightmare. Nearly every U.S. city faces a backlog of needed roadwork as streets built decades ago wear out. But the situation is especially vexing in Omaha, a sprawling city of 435,000 people, with 4,800 miles of roads and not enough tax revenue to maintain them. Decades ago, a number of developers sought permission to lay down asphalt roads rather than longer-lasting concrete in several sections in the middle of town and to skip installing curbs and gutters preferred by the city. The city agreed with the understanding that homeowners be responsible for occasional repaving. Some substandard roads also were in areas once outside the city but that were later annexed. For years, the arrangement held up, but the roads began to age and crumble. And as new residents replaced the original homeowners, resentment intensified about a city government that maintained some neighborhoods while ignoring others. Said neighbor Bill Manhart, it's like living in the country, but in the middle of a city. There's so much dust and mud on the street, what's the point? A series of meetings between city officials and residents of the affected neighborhoods, which included about 10,000 homes, hasn't resolved the problem. That's where we're going to leave this article. Going to Reopening Transforms 9/11 site. Reopening Transforms 9/11 site. Trade Center Mall now a symbol of hope, from AP. New York. The reopening and reinvention of the World Trade Center Mall Tuesday reflects how much Lower Manhattan has changed since the 9/11 attacks. Once a scene of massive destruction, the area is now a vibrant one of office towers and upscale hotels with three times the number of residences before the attacks, weekday employees and industries beyond Wall Street, and millions of tourists visiting every year. Shops from Apple to Forever 21 to H&M to John Varvatos will serve the increasingly diverse area where real estate experts say people have been eager for new stores and restaurants. The new spaces also let customers tap into technology as some retailers use the space for their latest ideas. The location is a symbol of hope, opportunity, progress, and perseverance, said Bill Hecht, chief operating officer of Westfield Corp's U.S. division. Westfield manages the retail properties, while the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey owns the real estate. More than 100 stores will occupy the 365,000-square-foot center, with about 60 opening Tuesday and the rest by the winter holiday season. That is the article that, and finishing it as we are going to be able to get to it as we finish part two of the Decatur in Review e-edition on Wednesday, August 17, 2016, as read by Debbie. Talk to you again soon.